All right, we're gonna have a little fun today. I like going over this passage because everybody's got an opinion as to what this is. So I get to give you mine. All right, so we're gonna start in verse number 13. He says, "For when God made the promise to Abraham, since he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself, saying, 'I will surely bless you, and I will surely multiply you.' And so, having patiently waited, he obtained the promise. For men swear by one greater than themselves, and with them an oath is given as confirmation, is an end to every dispute. In the same way, God, desiring even more to show to the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of his purpose, interposed with an oath, so that by two unchangeable things, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have taken refuge would have strong encouragement to take hold of the hope set before us. This hope we have is an anchor of the soul, a hope both sure and steadfast, and one which enters within the veil, where Jesus has entered as a forerunner for us, having become a high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek." So everybody likes to talk about, hey, what are the two unchangeable things? We'll get to that. Now, remember what we've been talking about. The beginning of chapter 6, he talks about leaving the elementary principles behind. He then talks about, hey, be careful you're not one of those folks that's thinking about leaving, because you can end up getting some hostility within you that's going to make it impossible to renew you again to repentance, especially if you're going back to the Old Testament sacrifices that the sacrifice of Christ replaced. You're walking on dangerous ground if that's what you're thinking about. So I'm just going to talk about this hypothetical person. If that's them, it's impossible to renew them again to repentance, and all that's left is judgment. He says in verse 9, though, he goes, but hey, I'm convinced of better things concerning you, right? I mean, I know where you're at. I know the struggles that you're facing, but I think better thoughts about you. And God does too. He's not so unjust so as to forget all the great things you've done for him in the service of the saints. And we need to make sure, though, that even though God is like that, we need to make sure that we have diligence, that we're not sluggish, and that we pay attention to those that have gone before us who are inheriting right now what God has promised. Now, the first example that he gives of a person that is still inheriting is Abraham. And we talked about that. It's like, how in the world is Abraham still inheriting? Well, we looked last week and we saw that, you know, he didn't inherit the promise. That's dependent upon us being brought in. So that the entire body, the bride that Brandon was talking about, being made ready. And when the father says, hey, son, go get her, the son's going to go get her because she's ready to go. So we don't know. You got to be ready. Now, we saw that what the real thing that's being inherited is a kingdom that cannot be shaken. Remember, these people were thinking about going back to the law, to the shadow, to Sinai. And so the writer of Hebrews says in chapter 12, verse 18, he goes, you haven't come to Sinai, to a mountain that can be touched, to all the things that were going on at that mountain. He goes, no, you've come to the heavenly Jerusalem. You've come to Mount Zion. You've come to the church, General Assembly and Church of the Firstborn. You've come to Christ. This is the kingdom that cannot be shaken. This is what you get to receive. This is what you are inheriting. Don't fall short. Don't fall short. Make sure you follow in the examples of the people that have gone before you. Specifically, listen to Abraham. We went to chapter 11 before we went through all of that and showed that Abraham wasn't looking for a physical place. He was looking for a city whose architect and builder is God. He's looking for a heavenly city. And notice it says there in chapter 11, it says, therefore, he's not ashamed to be called their God. Now, that's an interesting concept. If anybody should be ashamed of anybody, it should be God ashamed of humanity. But when it comes to the brethren, he is not ashamed of us, because we're covered in the righteousness of Christ. It doesn't mean that sometimes we don't do some things that, you know, need to be forgiven, of course. But when it comes to the final product, God is always, he's always looking at the end, isn't he? He's always looking way down the road at the completion of everything. And you know what God looks, if you stay in Christ, you know what he looks when he sees you? He sees a perfected bride made ready for her husband, his son. That's what he sees. That's why he's able to have grace with you and me. Because he sees what's coming at the end and he's like, all right, I know I want to smack him around right now, but I know where they're going to be at the end. We're going to have patience. They're going to figure it out. They're going to come along. They're going to get things straight. So Abraham, it says, if we look back there at chapter 6, the promise that he's specifically pointing out here is the one where he says, I will surely bless you and I will surely multiply you. And so having patiently waited, he obtained the promise. He didn't receive the whole promise at that particular time. He's still inheriting it. See? Because people are still becoming his seed, aren't they? They're still becoming the offspring of Abraham through Jesus Christ, aren't they? And every single time somebody gets immersed into Christ, Abraham is inheriting on the promise. So he's going to do that until the very end. That's really cool. I mean, everybody's always looking for the secret to passive income, aren't they? The kind of income where you don't even have to get out of bed and money gets deposited into your bank account. It's a magical thing if you can have it. And everybody's looking for it, where you don't have to lift a finger and that just gets deposited. Wonderful. Abraham has found the secret to passive inheritance, consistent inheritance. You know, just be, you know, the father, the progenitor of the Christ according to the flesh, and, you know, have that kind of faith that allowed him to be the one we're supposed to follow in that regard. And there you go. We're his seed when we get born again. Now, this concept of promise, of oath, of swearing, what does the New Testament tell us about that? Are you supposed to make oaths and swear? No, not at all. I mean, let's go to James chapter 5 for a second. I mean, you can go back to what Jesus said. Of course, Jesus said it in the Sermon on the Mount. But so does James. This is in verse 12. But above all, that kind of sounds important, right? Above all, my brethren, do not swear, either by heaven or by earth, or with any other oath, but your yes is to be yes, and your no, no, so that you may not fall under judgment. What's his point? It's like, you need to be the kind of people, when you say yes, I mean, you don't have to wonder if you're actually going to keep your yes, or if you're going to keep your no. You know, you don't want to be the kind of person that has to, you know, make an oath, you know, or, you know, swear on your children that you're going to do this. I don't even know what that means, you know, but people, you know, do that. Oh, okay. He swore on his children. Okay. Wow. I guess he's really, really serious about that. No, we're the kind of people that if I say yes, that this is who I am, this is what I'm going to do, that needs to be that kind of, I need to be that kind of person. You don't need to judge my truthfulness as to what level of oath I take. You know, do I swear by the altar or the gold on the altar? Right? That's important. Because if I swear by the altar, if I swear by the altar or the sacrifice on the altar, right? So if I swear by the altar, that's nothing. But if I swear by the sacrifice on the altar, oh, that's, you know, he's serious. Do we want to have those levels of concepts where you know, if someone says they're going to do it, but hey, I didn't swear. I didn't promise. Oh, so you're a liar. Okay, got it. Got it. Okay, that makes sense. But God, when he's talking about what's going on here, when he's talking about our salvation, when he's talking about our redemption, when he's talking about the high priesthood of Jesus, the one who's going to appear before God on our behalf to purchase our everlasting reconciliation and justification, he didn't need to do this. He could have just said, I'm going to do it. But God decided that he was going to use an oath to show how serious he is. He didn't have to. But again, based upon the importance of what is going on, God decided to use an oath to let you know this is serious. So let's look at the concept of the oath here in verse 16. He says, for men swear by one greater than themselves, and with them an oath given as confirmation is an end to every dispute. See, so the way it used to work is that if you've got a dispute and two people need to come together and someone needs to do something, they swear with an oath that it will be done, and it will be done. God's like, if you're going to make an oath, you keep your vows. If you make a vow before the Lord, you keep that vow. You don't renege on that vow. God doesn't like it. The Old Testament's full of that kind of stuff. He's like, you keep your vows. You keep your oaths. You do that. And again, the religious leaders found ways around that, didn't they? But that's not the way it's supposed to be. If you make an oath that you're going to do something, it gets done. That's just a basic principle. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. I think that's something that we all grab hold of. What I want to spend a little bit of time on is verse 17 and 18. He says, in the same way, God, desiring even more to show to the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of his purpose, interposed with an oath, so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have taken refuge would have strong encouragement to take hold of the hope set before us. So before we get into the two unchangeable things, let's discuss why God did this, because that's important. So it says, in the same way, God, desiring even more to show to the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of his purpose. In other words, God is not changeable, is he? I mean, there are times when prayer does change God's mind. Did it surprise God that Moses prayed and he relented of the calamity that he was planning upon Israel and chose to forgive them instead? Was God like, man, that Moses is really persuasive. You bring up a good point, Moses. I did not think about that. I did not think about what the nations were going to say if I brought them out of Egypt and destroyed them in the wilderness. I did not calculate the damage to my reputation that such an undertaking would incur. So thank you for bringing that to my mind, and therefore I repent and change. No. Does that mean that it was all for show? Because that's the other alternative that some people bring up. No. Did Moses change God's mind? Yes, he did. God was going to destroy them. He knew about the reputation. But he also had one of the greatest intercessors ever to live standing right before him. And he knew exactly the prayer that Moses was going to pray. And for the reason that Moses was going to pray it. And he put Moses there to pray that prayer to change his mind. I think that's super cool. God acts on our prayers. One of the reasons you're here now is to pray the prayers that only you can pray, to have God move in only the way that God can move through your prayers. They matter. He moves when we ask him. And every one of us has a different perspective. Every one of us has a different life. Every one of us thinks of things a little bit differently. And therefore, every one of our prayers are very different from each other. God placed you here and now to pray that prayer from that perspective, from that understanding of the scripture, so that he can move in a very specific way. God is sovereign. He sees the end before the beginning. And he's also operating with children and with free will. So he puts those children in exact place and point in time for you to do the exact things that you need to be doing to get the kingdom's purpose accomplished. So that's why every day that we get up is an important day. Every time we have that prayer time with God, it's an extremely important prayer time. Eternity could be riding on the prayer that you pray. That kind of makes us feel a little important, doesn't it? It's because we are. Jesus isn't dying for a bunch of people that aren't important. So, a little something else there, just on the side. So God can change his mind, but with this, when God declares something, he's not going to. When he says, I'm going to do this, he's going to do it. But then God's trying to underscore something here. What it says is he's desiring even more to show to the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of his purpose. We're the heirs to the promise. The patriarchs were the heirs to the promise. And he was trying to show them, emphasize the unchangeableness of his purpose. So God says, here's what I want to do. I'm going to have an oath. I'm going to swear. I can't lie anyway. I can't change anyway. I'm going to double down and show how serious I am on this. And I am going to interpose an oath that cannot be broken, so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have taken refuge would have strong encouragement to take hold of the hope that is set before us. Now, I always used to think that it being impossible for God to lie was one of the two unchangeable things. Nope, the two unchangeable, I'm now of the impression that the two unchangeable things are emphasized by the fact that it's impossible for God to lie. So here, everyone's got different views. Like I heard, you know, Jay just changed his view on it. And he goes back to chapter 5 and he says that the two unchangeable things are what's stated in verses 5 and 6. You are my son, today I've begotten you. And then you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. God states those, and therefore it's impossible for God to lie. Those are the two unchangeable things. That Jesus was begotten of God, and that he was the high priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. I think that's a good explanation. I have a different view. And the way that I decided to do it, to go about it, was I decided to look up that word oath. And I wanted to see how the writer of Hebrews used it in other passages and see if there's anything in there that would explain what the two unchangeable things are. Because I thought, if he's talking about an oath, maybe we see where he swore with an oath, and are there two things in there that are unchangeable? And that's when I found it. It's in chapter 7. The next time we see it, we see this. Now, I'm going to go back to verse 18, get some context. He says, for on the one hand, there is a setting aside of a former commandment because of its weakness and uselessness. For the law made nothing perfect. And on the other hand, there is the bringing in of a better hope through which we draw near to God. Now, that's Jesus' priesthood, right? But look at verse 20. And inasmuch as it was not without an oath, oh, God swore with an oath. I think we might be getting it here. For they indeed became priests without an oath, but he with an oath, through the one who said to him, the Lord has sworn, number one, and will not change his mind. Number two, and here's the oath, you are a priest forever. So yeah, I think Jay's right. You are a priest forever. That's the oath. But I think the two unchangeable things in which it's impossible for God to lie is the Lord has sworn. God can't lie about that. He has sworn. And he will not change his mind. That's the other thing. Two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie. I think sometimes what folks think is that the two unchangeable things are the oath itself. I think the two unchangeable things emphasize the unchangeable nature of the oath. That the oath is, you, because that's what it says, right? Verse 21, for they indeed became priests without an oath, but he with an oath through the one who said to him, he's about to tell you what the oath is. The Lord sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. That's it. He's not changing his mind. He has sworn that is unchangeable and God cannot lie. So the two unchangeable things are emphasizing the unchangeableness of his purpose. What two things could he say better for the unchangeableness of his purpose than the Lord has sworn and he won't change his mind? In which it's impossible for God to lie. So that's what I think the two unchangeable things are. The two unchangeable things is that the Lord has sworn and he will not change his mind and God can't lie. So when he makes the oath, you are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek, which is found back there in verse 5 or chapter 5, which is one of the points that Jay brought up, but which is really the main point that Jay was bringing up, was the oath is that Jesus is the high priest according to the order of Melchizedek, and God can't lie. He's not going to lie about that. He can't change his mind about that. That's going to happen. I think you still get to the same thing. I just think the two unchangeable things, the Lord has sworn and he will not change his mind, and that emphasizes, the unchangeableness of his purpose. Because there's one thing that God wanted to emphasize and underscore, and that is that Jesus Christ is a priest forever. So why is that so important? Well, the writer of Hebrews goes on to say why that's important. Let's look at verse 22. So much the more also Jesus has become the guarantee of a better covenant. How do we know? I mean, think about what he's writing to these people. They're thinking about going back to another covenant. He's trying to tell them their covenant that they're in is the one that's been promised, that the patriarchs were looking for, that it's better in every way. And he says, look, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever. And that is the guarantee of the better covenant. So much the more. I think that's pretty emphatic. Our covenant is guaranteed. If you were to ask a Jew today, what's salvation and how do you attain it? I heard a rabbi, because the rabbi was asked about that. And he was comparing it to Christianity. And the rabbi said, this is funny. It's sad, but it's funny. He said, the Jewish system is very different than the Christian system. He said, in the Jewish system, the idea of sacrificial substitutionary atonement is foreign. Okay. Think about that for 2 seconds. He says the concept of the Old Testament of having a sacrifice be a substitutionary atonement is foreign to the Old Testament. The entire Old Testament law was built upon animal sacrifice as a substitutionary atonement. But when you don't have a temple anymore, you got to figure out something else, because your whole concept of salvation now has been missing for 2,000 years. You got to figure out something else. So the rabbi said this: we have a works-based salvation. Live a good life, you go to heaven. And for them, essentially, basically every Jew goes to heaven. You know the old movie, All Dogs Go to Heaven? So I think for them, it's like all Jews go to heaven, just about. So I don't know what you got to do to not go to heaven. I guess be a Gentile. I don't know. There's no guarantee. I'd like you to think about that for a second. Imagine, because a lot of religions are like this. Hinduism's like this. Buddhism's like this. Islam is like this. They're all workspace. What kind of confidence would you have if you were of the belief that your actions determined whether or not you were going to go to heaven or not? You know, Barry mentioned it in his beginning about the forgiveness that we have and how it's not based on what we do. It's all because of him, and that's why we love him so much. Think about that. How would you ever know you did enough? How would you ever know if you were good enough? Is there any kind of a guarantee with that? We all like guarantees. I typically buy stuff that has guarantees. The longer, the better. Sometimes I'll even buy the extended guarantees. Sometimes they help to rebuild engines in Kia Souls that go out too early and save you $11,000. That's pretty nice, isn't it? Might not be a bad idea if you buy a used rental car. You know, just might not be a bad idea. I'm so thankful we bought that. I typically never buy an extended warranty on a vehicle, but I'm like, this one might, maybe. We like guarantees. You want to know what the new covenant system is? It's a guarantee. Because the righteousness doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the only one that has ever overcome, that never sinned, and then died and gave his blood. But that's not the end of it. He had to have a legal means by which he could go into heaven and be that mediator and be that high priest. You know where that guarantee comes from? It comes from the unchangeableness of God's purpose. It comes from the unchangeableness of the oath. Two unchangeable things. The Lord has sworn he will not change his mind. And then he makes the oath. You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek, a royal kingly priest, a priest ruling on his throne. Let's go back to chapter 6, verse 18, and let's finish out the thought of the sentence. So that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have taken refuge would have strong encouragement to take hold of the hope that is set before us. Man, the concept of the law of Moses didn't have a super strong encouragement to take hold of the hope. There was hope there, but you had to really look for it. A lot of it was based on fear, because it's law. In the new covenant, there is a hope that is set before us, and we're going to spend time in 19 and 20 next week. There's some really cool stuff in 19 and 20 that I want to discuss. There is a hope that is set before us that is made possible by two unchangeable things, in which it is impossible for God to lie, based upon the unchangeableness of his purpose. And that is the refuge that we take under the shadow of the high priesthood of Jesus, the guarantee of a better covenant, that he is able. I mean, it says it, if we go back to chapter 7, verse 25, I know I'm getting a little bit ahead of us here. So he's writing, therefore, that the conclusion of all of this, this oath that he gave, therefore, he is able to save forever those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. Man, what a guarantee of a better covenant. He saves forever those who draw near to him. I sure am glad that God made an oath. I sure am glad that the Lord has sworn and that he will not change his mind and that it's impossible for him to lie and that he made the sinless sacrifice, Jesus Christ, our high priest forever, so that we have a means by which he can legally and justly enter into the Holy of Holies, sprinkle his blood on that mercy seat, and save forever all who draw near to him. All right, that's it for today. Questions or comments as we wrap up this evening?
The incomparable Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, you brought those other religions, sense of comparing those. And I'm in depth knowledge of those, I do not. But still, just the stuff here, and God who cannot lie. I mean, the incomparable Jesus Christ, mm-hmm. any other thing in the world, or someone's going to believe in, there's no comparison. And then, in a sense, those other religions say God's a liar. In a sense, I mean, Jesus is not who you say. He's not. Other people can save you. Well, no, that's not true. Other ways can save you. No.
Yep.
There's no comparison to who he was and what he's done and everything. It's mind-boggling.
It is. And what's interesting is just about from every major religion on the face of the earth right now has Jesus in it. A fake version of who Jesus is. They have to deal with him. Everybody does. Jews dismiss him. They won't even say his name. The rabbis that I listen to, they won't even say his name. They call him JC. And then they joke about him and call him JC Penny and blaspheme him because and they say it jokingly, like he's a nothing, he's a nobody. Islam deals with him. But they deny the atonement, they deny the high priesthood, they deny the sacrifice, they deny the resurrection. Hinduism, he's one of the 300 million gods that they have. Buddhism, he's one of the Buddhas that had enlightenment. You know, they all deal with him in some way, shape, or form. But they lie about him. You're absolutely right. They all lie about him. This is the real Jesus. And I'm glad that's him. David?
I think in my mind, I always, I guess, accidentally put it to two unchangeable oaths. So I think that's good because it kind of reframes that a little bit. I want to make sure that I got this straight. It's a singular oath of the priesthood. You are a priest forever.
Yes.
Bound up and solidified by those two unchangeable things.
That is correct.
Yeah.
Yep. So let me say that again. So you said it's the one singular oath bound up and solidified by the two unchangeable things.
Yeah.
Brilliant way to say it. Much better than the way I did. So excellent.